BizSpark Show is brought to you by Microsoft BizSpark, a program for entrepreneurs. Three-year program. If you're making less than $1 million, you're less than five years old, and you want to leg up and you want to have free software and support services and access to mentorship and accelerator programs, join BizSpark, www.bizspark.com. We have a special guest. For me, it's a very special guest because I actually have talked to Alexandra Mysore before about, we were talking earlier, 4 years ago maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a serial entrepreneur. She and her husband both, you're both serial entrepreneurs. You've started up a baby's goods company called Generation Orange. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let you go through your timeline, but mm-hmm. I am going to say a few things about you just from your bio. Very young female entrepreneur who has had a lot of success. She was the International Young Turk in 2008 for her success as a Gen Y entrepreneur. Inc. magazine named her a top entrepreneur to watch in 2011, and Huffington Post has named her a top 40 under 40 entrepreneur. You've also been recognized by the Kauffman Foundation. You were a showcase speaker at the Global Entrepreneurship Week, Digital Hollywood Internet Retailer, and you're part of the Extreme Entrepreneurship Tour. And we want to talk about this later. You're filming a pilot for ABC about being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I don't.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, but they didn't buy it. Thank goodness, though.
Why? Because it would have been a reality show.
Yeah, I think they
disaster.
Did. Well, yeah, I don't think that they were getting the spirit and the essence of what I think entrepreneurship is about. But what a fantastic experience!
Yeah, so you saw how the butter is made, or whatever
I
that
did.
Phrase is.
Reality shows are not reality.
Thank
go
you.
Figure.
And that is the message. That is the message for today. So why don't you go through your timeline?
Yeah.
When you started your first company, and then what brings you up to today, and we can just get an essence of who you are.
Sure. So basically, I went to Cal, and I thought, like every good Indian girl, my parents are from India, but I'm born and brought up here, that I would be a doctor.
Yeah.
And when I realized very quickly that I did not enjoy the process, I liked the idea of helping people, maybe being a doctor. ER was big in my head. Mm-hmm. George Clooney, you know. My parents were really upset. So I had to find a job. And the first job I had basically was in PR. And while I didn't tremendously enjoy PR, I felt like, okay, well, this will do for right now. And I kind of got lost in the world of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, and then I got fired a couple times. We'll kind of
wait, that's the most important part. Did you do something wrong?
No,
you talked back to your boss?
Or? No, you know, I just... I couldn't
you
imagine
it wasn't
working.
In it. You weren't in it.
I couldn't imagine working at Cubicle Farm. That was shocking to
yes.
me for 40 plus hours for the rest of my life. And so that didn't really work. But I still needed to make some money. So basically, I got this brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I was not a capitalist yet at all.
Okay. apparently, you are.
But I got this brilliant idea that if I could make the same amount of money, not commute, which, by the way, wasn't a lot of money in the first place, and watch Oprah do yoga, like I had it made. And so basically, I ended up consulting, freelancing.
Yeah.
And that turned into something bigger. And then I thought, wow, maybe I'm an entrepreneur. Maybe that's what this is.
Yeah.
So my first business was actually starting off in PR, but at the time, calling it digital PR because blogs were new, Facebook was new. I don't even think anyone could be on it. We could because you had to be in college. And so that became sort of a niche for me.
Yeah.
When I had my son, by the way, I didn't love it. Still, so that was an issue. I didn't love PR.
You didn't love doing digital PR.
But I liked, I didn't hate it. I think it's so important, but I didn't love what I was doing. I didn't feel like I was fulfilling my potential. And when I had my son, I got this, I had, you know, I lived in LA. You can hire somebody for everything. Feed your baby, put them to sleep. But anyways, there was a baby nurse who told me that the bottles I had something called BPA in them, which is a very nasty chemical.
It causes cancer.
Exactly.
Right,
that
apparently.
A lot of people know about now.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was still kind of unknown. And products were not labeled BPA-free. In fact, many of them still had them. So I went on this search looking for BPA-free bottles, could not find them. One thing led to another. I found a distributor. And I had to buy these bottles in a case pack.
Yeah.
And I thought, what the heck am I going to do with all these bottles? And so,
I got this
idea that maybe I should open up a store for products that were eco-friendly. And at the time, there was a lot of news coming on into the news about lead in kids' toys and all sorts of things. And of course, I don't know if this was because I was a new mother, I was more sensitive to it, or if this was becoming a real problem. So I have zero technical skills, but I bartered. So that's how I got my first e-commerce website.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have Shopify back then. We didn't have Amazon Web Store. We didn't have any of those things. So I found these kids in college nearby, and they had a startup. I said, I'd help you with PR if you'd build me my first
Yeah, that's how a lot of people I know got started.
Yeah, it was so bad. It was built on Joomla. It was so bad. We were not sure yet if we were trying to be like a Facebook for mommies meets you know, but very quickly we knew we needed to make money. And so we had to streamline less content. It was distracting people and more focused on the products.
Yeah.
And then we iterated and we got smarter. And then it was, by the way, start out of my home. So when a palette came, I didn't know what a palette was.
And where you put the palette?
In the
backyard?
And yes, no, we got kicked out. And so that's what led to scaling.
Okay.
And then we really quickly, we got the grip of what we were doing. And, you know, things really kind of rapidly went from there.
And so basically, how many companies have you started? It was a digital PR agency,
yes,
this one, the baby one.
Yes. And then Shanth, which is my newest venture.
Which I feel like, I may interrupt you, is basically a whole encapsulation of your entire experience.
That's right.
Of how you learn to take an online world and shape it for the offline world, right? So you, with Shanth, is sort of like, I want to say that you're sort of like this digital enhancement creative agency for brands, helping them figure out the offline-online hybridization of retail.
Oh, I like your description of it. Yeah, that sounds so
sexy. That's
what
you do. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you do that with your husband, or do that online?
Yes, well, you know what? That's a whole probably another show. But my husband and I ended up being just not only tremendous partners in life, but just we work so well together that we ended up being just great business partners. And I think that...
So you made this thing.
Yeah, and we also... So we just continued along. You know, I think a lot of founding teams continue on once they have successful sort of exits. And I think it's no different with us. But basically, Shanth is, in just simple words, an omni-channel consultancy. So we help brands and retailers figure out online to offline, offline to online, customer acquisition, all sorts of sort of business topics. I think CEOs of these big brands had... what's the word I'm looking for? I think they had the advantage to be able to sit in the front row, eat popcorn, and kind of watch the innovation happening here in Silicon Valley. But I think things are moving at such supersonic speed now, they no longer can do that. Yeah. They have to get involved.
So let's talk about what that change is,
right?
So one of the things we were talking about earlier is that you said something about there's a new thing in outside of Philadelphia called Devon's Yard.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So,
so what is that? Explain what that is.
So let me take a step back and give it a little context. So one of the interesting things about e-commerce is, of course, all the real-time data that we can get and just the analytics around our customers. I think that's something so tremendously useful. And I think we see that being mimicked in a way with offline, meaning brick and mortars. And so one example is a mall in Tokyo called Shibuya 109. So basically, it's this entire mall. It's fantastic. You should look it up on YouTube if you haven't been there yourself, just to kind of see it. But basically, it's a mall geared towards tweens and folks under 30. And it's just the look and feel is tremendous. You know, the types of stores are really tailored to their needs. And when you go and kind of, if you ever have the opportunity to visit, it's just tremendous.
Yeah.
But also, we see things like that happening here in the States in a different kind of way. So Urban Outfitters was getting really sick of being next to, like, I don't know, a TCBY or any of these sorts of food court type places. So they decided that they'd like to create their own experience. So 30 minutes outside of Philadelphia, Urban Outfitters, Inc. is in the process of building a 6.4-acre, I don't know what to call it, but like a...
It's almost like a web portal, but it's offline, right?
But I mean, for women, it's a utopia. Shocking.
Yeah, that's the marketer's spin on it. But it's basically what the point is that there's all of these things that are happening in bricks and mortar that look like some of the most recent innovations that have happened with apps and sort of... devices and sort of the cloud and the things, you know, the sort of omnivorous nature of consumers of the web, right? So you have like the Shibuya 109 is like, for me, an example of like, it's like the path for malls, right? It's like you only have the things that are essential to that vertical in that place. And it's almost like a private space just for tweens to shop that kind of consumer market. But then you have this other thing, which is almost like a portal approach where it's like you have all these specific types of stores and a whole sort of roving manner of beasts can go in there and look for the stuff that they want. The reason I wanted you to have you on the show is because I feel like in many cases, e-commerce has always sort of stood outside of offline. Mm-hmm. And now we're really starting to see them merge. And I wanted you to be able to talk to us about where are those opportunities and where are those trends mm-hmm. for other entrepreneurs out there who might be trying to figure out commerce. But let me ask you this question mm-hmm. that was sent by someone else. Do you use offline data and mm-hmm. data that's not specifically analytics from like web traffic mm-hmm. or devices to help in your consultancy for retailers to figure out the things that they should be prepared for or how their consumers are shopping? That's a question that was asked from the audience here.
Yeah, well, we definitely look at global trends 100%. Yeah. And that we have like trend spotters, I like to call them, mm-hmm. all over the world. And I think just like watching how people shop, watching how people eat, just like mm-hmm. mannerisms is a really good way. So I think that's number one.
Is that more important than data? I mean, that's a different kind of
yeah.
data.
But I think it gives context to the data. I mm-hmm. think it's one of those things. I mean, you can't build a business just looking at a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And I think so context is really important. And I think, you know, one of the things that we were talking about also is current affairs. Obviously, I mean, when the government had their shutdown, I mean, serious supply chain issues with things being yeah. stuck in customs. So yeah. supply chain continues to be a really big piece of bringing all these distribution channels together. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that one of the ways that I think a lot of these big brands are sort of, I don't know, I want to say fighting back Amazon, but dealing with the Amazon as a giant mm-hmm. Is using the assets that they have. So, you know, I know that Tory Burch, as an example, is using their outlets or actual physical stores as dropship centers. So you can order online, pick up right there.
Yeah.
And so they have to reshuffle their merchandise allocation. So things are changing rapidly, even in supply chain.
So when you talk to people, what does mm-hmm. omnichannel mean? What mm-hmm. and then how is that actually impacting the mm-hmm. business?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think anyone really knows fully what it means, but I think directionally what I think the essence of it is right now is that we are seeing it's much more about the brand and customer experience, period. Yeah. And what do you call the shopper that browses online but buys in the store? What do you call the shopper that's in the store and price comparing, posting
on the phone,
on Instagram on their phone, and then buying online? What do you call the shopper that uses their checkout as a wish list but then goes in the store? How do you can't classify these shoppers anymore. They're looking for tools from a brand to help with their shopping and customer purchase decision and journey. So I think that's key. And when you look at it as that being the kernel and what are all the things that feed into it, you no longer should be looking at e-commerce as something that operates over here.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the challenges that I was surprised to see when we started this consultancy is we went in kind of like ready to go solving these business issues, but it became so much more about reorganizing the organization, making sure that the marketing folks and the merchandise folks are really in sync yeah. with e-commerce, that the marketing person is really in sync with the store manager and so on and so on. I've been really surprised how different the org charts look at so many of these retail and brands.
Yeah. This is something we should talk about because you've said before that you want to kind of be the next Bain, but you mm-hmm. want, how are you different than that?
You know, I'd like to think that we come from an operating experience. And yeah. I mean, you know, Bain and McKinsey, just from what I've read and their background really was they were professors who were really great at analytics and
yeah.
looking
accountants
at the spreadsheet.
And stuff,
yeah,
yeah.
And I think that's, there's such a value. I just think we have a different voice, which is we were operators mm-hmm. and we continue to sort of be at the forefront of innovation being based here in Silicon Valley. And we yeah. try to bring some of these things to the big brand. So we're meeting all day long with startups and, you know, not so startup, but interesting tools and tactics that will sort of help these brands and retailers string together little competitive edges.
Yeah, let me slow you down for a second,
yeah.
because you actually said we have a different voice.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I think that's interesting is because that's something you would hear from people who are really deeply nurtured by the social web, I
mm-hmm.
think. I mean, and you said it before earlier in this interview, mm-hmm. that you had the internet mm-hmm. in college, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you had blogging. So your mm-hmm. first idea for a business came up with digital PR. You're like, mm-hmm. oh, I will teach people and help them, assist them in mm-hmm. getting into this space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you fast forward to, like, I don't know when you were in school. It must have been like
2002,
graduated. Right? Yeah, you're a little younger
That's
than me.
That's rude.
Yeah. But you fast forward now, and it almost seems to me that if you want to approach any type of consumer, the ones who are the quickest to act mm-hmm. and actually consume,
mm-hmm.
you actually have to be fluent in the voice of the web, don't you? I mean, you.
I think we're beyond that. I think if you're not fluent in the web, like sayonara for sure. Yeah. I mean, you're seeing things like, I mean, you know, just listen to CNBC. You're seeing retail numbers for some of these brands that you're like, what is going on? Exactly. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I think we're beyond that. And I think you have to even keep up. I mean.
Yeah, but what does that mean for someone? Mm-hmm. So if I'm a CMO, let's say I'm a CMO of one of these retailers and I'm actually been having panic attacks. Mm-hmm. What is it that I should know? And also, what is it that an entrepreneur who's trying to tackle this space, what should they be able to say when they're going off and trying to tackle these brands, either to disrupt them or to assist them?
Well, I think let's answer the question of entrepreneurs and startups. So we've been meeting with a lot of different types of startups. So data analytic companies, folks that have tools that can help brick and mortar outlets, things like that. And they're having a tough time getting past pilot stage. Yeah. And I think a lot of that has to do with coming down to the org chart. So I think step number one is figuring out who is the right person to talk to. And it seems like a no-brainer, but no one entirely knows who's the decision maker for things like this that have never been done before. Yeah. So I think being really leery of that. And then for the CMO of a big brand and a big retailer, I think it's important to think about as customer acquisition. So if you're, I mean, if your customers are not on Facebook anymore and they've moved on somewhere else, like you need to pay attention to that.
Is this because for a very long time, the offline retail world had a lot of moats and walls around it? I mean, it seems to me like this is the same kind of incumbents problem that you've seen in media or you've seen in other verticals, right?
I think you're absolutely spot
on. You just don't know what's going on.
I think the reason that they know that these big retailers have their eyes wide open is that I wouldn't say that companies based and born out of the internet have necessarily eaten their lunch per se. I don't think that's entirely true. I think we thought it was going to be and it didn't quite happen that way. But I think it was enough where customers started demanding some of these sorts of tools. I mean, like Amazon has spoiled everyone.
Yeah. And do you think that's because really like people when they grow up in this kind of space like you did, like the way that they see the internet, the way they use mobile devices, the way apps have been such a presence on phones and have changed the way phones have been used, that's also kind of changed our brains and the way we select things. I mean, is that kind of what you're also trying to?
I think that's, you know, customer and purchase behavior has certainly changed. And I think forward thinking even more. So you hit it on the nail. I mean, I think even our moms and grandmas are now using their smartphones and starting to shop online. I mean, the numbers show it, right? Yeah. But I think forward thinking, there's a trend of, I think it's called point no buy. So it's what's going to happen with the Google glasses or what happens when you have your phone and you can sort of view
augmented
the product.
Reality, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So
Nokia is doing a lot of that.
That's right. And there are a lot of other cool companies. I think there's one called Blipper or Blipar. I don't know how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. Doing cool stuff as well. And a lot of big brands are sort of buying into pilots and testing it out. But I think the next time we talk, hopefully it's not 4 years from now, but the next time we talk, that's going to be a big part of our experience because we now see the word. Like my son, he's 6.5. He's much more fluent. The first time I told him to shut off the TV, I still remember he was like maybe 1.5 or 2. He was trying to touch it like an iPad. Yeah. He was so confused that there was a button that you didn't just, and it got me thinking that that's absolutely right. Our new lens is through a screen. So it would make sense that we would go to a brick and mortar outlet, use our phone or device or watch or Google Glasses.
Well, I think it's really central what I hear, and I have another question from the audience to tee up for you, but what I hear and what I experience when I'm shopping is that a well-designed view of the world that's been delivered to me through really well-done apps and websites and really well-done like live video or anything like something like this show, it makes me think of the offline space in a completely different way. Like,
that's right.
I'll be on an airplane even and wanting to shop from the Sky Mall or whatever. And my expectation of what could be delivered to me when and how it's given to me, I'm already frustrated, right? So I'm imagining, how are you helping retailers then support e-commerce? Because I'm sure just as e-commerce might be able to train these sort of retailers about what the online world is like, isn't there something missing? There's got to be stuff missing in the online world that retailers should be very fluent at.
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's not about separate, it's coming together. This idea of things like using your retail outlets as a drop ship pickup location. Because one of the things that is so frustrating about online shopping is that you have to wait. There's not this immediate gratification. So I think that's number one. Number two is, I mean, there's tons of statistics out there talking about how so many girls are using their checkouts, I mean men too, using their checkouts as wish lists. I think it's really important for there to be some sort of seamless sort of system so when you walk into to the store, you know, a sales associate who's working on commission, when she's going to approach you and probably annoy you anyways, mm-hmm. has an idea of your price sensitivities, your mm-hmm. sizing, your style. I think it's a much more effective relationship.
So how do you handle discussions about privacy then in mm-hmm. that space? I mean, that's something that's
a really big issue.
I mean, you see this conflict in unnamed web browser issues, mm-hmm. search engines versus other search engines. Consumers are rallying behind fighting for privacy. There are so many issues out there now. How do you talk with retailers about handling this discussion? Because it seems to me it is a conversation between a consumer who has an expectation of a certain deliverability, but then a certain paranoia about the invasion of that privacy. So what do you do?
I think twofold. Number one, I think it's been 2 weeks now, there was new legislation passed mm-hmm. starting to talk about groundworks about what you can and cannot do, which is really helpful for these data analytic companies and for consumers. But I also think number two, it's just time. I mean, I remember Webvan. Okay, I remember thinking, who is going to buy their groceries online mm-hmm. and who's going to put all their credit card info? But people do it day in, day
out.
Yeah,
but here's the thing. What was the other company? Steve Blank talks about this company that was in the same space maybe in the 90s.
Yeah.
The problem there, and this goes exactly to what mm-hmm. the kind of work you do, is that they made a correct assumption about what people wanted, mm-hmm. but they made the incorrect assumptions about how to scale and grow the company because mm-hmm. they were using offline models mm-hmm. to try to treat a web-based world. Let's go through some steps.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm an entrepreneur and I want to work in the e-commerce space. Mm-hmm. We have one here. Nick is visiting. I don't know if you're visiting from Russia or he lives mm-hmm. here now. But he has an e-commerce mm-hmm. space. Is there sort of a list you go through? It's like when you're trying to grow up your company and mm-hmm. scale your company, the do not do's, the do's, or the first steps? I mean, what do you usually tell people
like
this?
Well, I think for e-commerce companies, especially based out here in the Valley or sort of bred out of this tech world as opposed to brand world, you have to think about your merchandise. I think people took their eye off the ball of simple business principles. What's your margin? Like, you know, it's not, you don't want it to be a price war. If five people are selling the same thing as you, it's about pricing.
Yeah.
You're not going to make any money.
And but do you find e-commerce shops that they're just not aware of pricing, of what their competitors are doing?
No, I mean, what do you mean? Like,
well, I mean, if your pricing's all skewed, mm-hmm. then you may be losing to lower priced mm-hmm. retailers. But mm-hmm. then shouldn't you know that? Shouldn't you have something built into your e-commerce system? You know, Amazon does that where it mm-hmm. scrapes everything around the web and it figures out if mm-hmm. there's been a penny drop somewhere, they match it.
You know, there's lots of technology like that, and people are using it.
Is it just a standard now? Or
it should be.
Yeah,
it definitely should be. But my thing to that is you're not making money.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, if it's different, I guess, if you're venture-backed because the bottom-line expectations are different. But
sure.
I like to think about things in, like, traditional business sense. Like, you spend a penny, you make two pennies, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's really changed. I think the temperament has changed.
So so what does that mean? You don't think we're in the world anymore where because it's on the web, you're just bound to make a crap load of money?
Well, and I don't think that some of these web companies have made a crap load of money.
Yeah.
It's if they exited, maybe they did, but I don't think that they were cash heavy companies. Mm-hmm. You know, they were taking things at a loss. So I think companies now being bred in this next version of brand building, not just e-commerce, maybe they're starting online mm-hmm. first, but they're seriously looking at an offline and other distribution channels I think catalog is still, by the way, a very viable mm-hmm. model. I mean, it's incredible. I know it sounds archaic, but
do you think more investors are actually looking to back companies like that, that have that kind of hybrid, that it's not just, oh, this is, you know, the next pure play e-commerce hit?
I think the smart ones are.
Yeah.
I think the smart ones should be asking the question about the brand and the merchandise. Is there a rich enough margin involved? What's the defensibility of the product? How is your supply? What is your, you know, supply chain efficiency going to look like so you can eke out more money as you scale, as opposed to the other way around, which is sell more, lose more? That doesn't make sense.
Any guesses on what's going on with some big players in that space? Kind of like Fab. What's going on with Fab, do you think?
I can't necessarily speculate, but I mean, I think that I think at least with what's been reported, I don't think it was a big surprise to them either. I think that's why they are trying to shift, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to survive. And I think they're realizing that, you know, they need to sort of change what they're doing. And I think a big piece of that is owning your merchandise, 100%. I mean, the success, you know, you look at what is that list? The 10 richest people. The guy who founded Zara is on the list. Mm-hmm. H&M guys, IKEA. It's because they own their product.
Hmm. So whose success stories in that area do you think? You said Zara and all mm-hmm. that, but like the up and coming, the people you have your eye on, anybody, or are you trying to keep it all under your...
Of course, yeah.
Trying to keep the cards.
Trying
hidden.
To keep the cards to myself, but you know, truth be told,
okay,
I'm still
tell me about
waiting.
The define it. Define maybe if you don't know a name,
like
or
a criteria.
You wanna,
yeah, you know,
what
definitely.
What do you think is going to make it?
I think a company that is very focused on their customer, that is not broad, that is not a retailer, but building a brand.
Yeah,
I think that's key.
All right. So if you're an entrepreneur who's trying to do that, mm-hmm. Are there two or three things that you would advise them to have right away, other than the merchandising, other than owning your own mm-hmm. thing, mm-hmm. in their thinking and building mm-hmm. that company? What should be? What steps should
I
they be taking?
100% multi-distribution day one.
Yeah.
And not being too reliant on one sort of distribution channel. Mm-hmm. So definitely that. Number two, I wouldn't buy customers necessarily. I'd be really thoughtful about buying customers, which is like what everybody does. Mm-hmm. It's not the right thing to do. The lifetime value of that customer just isn't that rich. They don't mm-hmm. come back. So thinking about that is really important. And I think just thinking about the story. I mean, yeah. I can't tell you how simple that is, but how important that still really yeah. is. Because I think that if you can get that to spread in a way, and I think a lot of folks today want to feel like they discovered it. I mean, the success of things like, at a much smaller scale, of course, but like yeah. Blue Bottle, right? Like, oh, I discovered it. You feel like you discovered it.
Yeah, exactly.
That feeling is important.
So a kind of marketing that helps the customer tell their own story, maybe?
That
sounds a lot to me like what I've seen some other companies do. Yeah. There's a company called Partnered, for example. So mm-hmm. Partnered is basically spending their time building up a platform so that people can come and meet each other, mm-hmm. right? And what's part of that is a very strong sense of open and available information. And it mm-hmm. seems to me that retailers also could learn from that kind of thing. It's a lesson that Partnered learned from AngelList. Mm-hmm. When you put the right information there and you make mm-hmm. it freely available, mm-hmm. you get a whole bunch of people to come and they start making a community together.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any room in this kind of web? You know, I feel like we've moved beyond blogging
mm-hmm.
and now we're just trying to reach customers who are out in the universe somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any kind of room for that kind of community building for retail? Should they be doing that, or should they strictly stick to product and product story?
I think there are a lot of people who are trying to build community, like the LinkedIn for so-and-so or the Facebook for so-and-so, or much more segmented type of social networks. And I think that retailers should just keep their eye on that. I don't think that they should do something so outside of what their core competency is.
So you think advertising in general will just work for retailers? Because you're talking about being multi-channel, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, and multi-distribution mm-hmm. of the product. From what I understand,
mm-hmm.
is it enough though just to try to earn media or own media? Should they be doing something else to keep people there?
I think that's where it comes down to the experience. That's where, you know, we started talking about privacy, and I think the point I wanted to make as well is that, you know, I think as these brands start to develop, I'm going to call them apps for a lack of a better word right mm-hmm. now. Useful shopping companions that they can use while they're shopping, mm-hmm. they're opting into. So now that sort of barrier of privacy kind of comes down a little more, because now as a consumer, I'm getting something that's really helpful, it's worth it to me, and I trust that retailer, so it's okay. So we think building that experience is key. So, you know, if you think about going back to Zara as a great example, their stores were their only source of advertising.
Yeah.
And so it's, you can use the word advertising, but what does that mean, right? So mm-hmm. I think that brick and mortar outlets have a huge advantage right now.
I was going to say, because it sounds to me like if you're going to start an e-commerce company, you better be also thinking about offline. That's got to be pretty expensive though, right? I mean, that's real estate, mm-hmm. that's employees, mm-hmm. that's physical objects, and physical objects are always more expensive than the imaginary ones, the words and the bits and the bytes, right?
I mean, I think us sitting here, we feel uncomfortable with that. I remember talking to a venture capitalist years ago and telling him I was going to start Generation Orange. He's like, "You're going to have real product? You're going to have real product?" I was like, "Yes, I'm going to have real product." And so I think that a couple years from now, we're going to be saying the same thing. Like, we're going to open up a real store. Yeah, I just got an invitation to art.com's pop-up store is happening this Thursday.
So you must have venture capital then to be able to grow in this space.
I don't think that that's true. I mean, you look at Spanx. I mean, she didn't take any outside money, and she built it through various channels. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots. Nasty Gal did a good job.
Does she have offline stores? She has some
flagship stores now. Yeah. But yes, she's also distributing in other stores. Okay. You know, I don't think you need to have venture capital to do something. I mean, I think it's like it's great. I think there's scenarios where it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But I don't think you need to have.
See, I'm going to disagree with you on that because we'll see. I mean, maybe some. In the audience will do their research because I don't have time to do it. No, and maybe come back with the answer, because it seems to me that I don't know, maybe property is really cheap, maybe creative talent is really cheap. I don't think it is. I think it's kind of expensive to get really good creative talent.
I think you're not going to have all VCs, that. It's not going to be perfect.
But let's be honest too. And I also, it sounds like you would need a lot of money, and I'm not here to argue or anything.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Sounds like you would need a lot of money. And from what I know, when I've looked at companies that might have a strong human element to them, which I would associate with the offline part, investors don't seem that interested in that, because it feel like that's like top heavy. I think that's really, that eats away at margins and stuff like that. So we'll see.
Makes it more defensible, because if you have the right product, it's a lot more defensible. Again, like you should be thinking about stringing together a series of defensibilities. And I think, you know, if you can get someone to make that purchase and get it right now, I mean, how does that affect your bottom line in a really, really earnest way? And I think the second thing, though, is I think we have come to a place now where, as entrepreneurs, I think we're savvy enough to know that just because VCs are not investing in a space doesn't mean that space isn't going to flourish.
That's really important. Yeah.
And I mean, when you look at their returns, I always say the proof is in the pudding. 9 out of 10 of their companies fail. So whose fault is that, right? Yeah. And so I think it's about just being really earnest, being really scrappy, being really resourceful. And frankly, building a brand's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. You need a lot of grit. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to invent some software and put it out there and sit back and just cash the check. No, building a brand is hard work.
Yeah. I think I saw an article. I don't know if Alexis Ohanian wrote this, but there was an article I saw recently called, if you're building a brand, rely on your micro brand first, because it's the little stories that you're telling it are get you there. Anyway, we've run out of time.
Okay.
It's been great to have you on the show.
Buddy.
Yes. And we'll have to have you come back at some point. And you'll have to tweet us in a couple of weeks or so when you're going to be announcing some news.
Yes,
and
I will.
You'll have to use the hashtag BizSpark to let us know, and we'll be monitoring it. And for those of you out there who have enjoyed this conversation with Alexandra Mysore, you can find her at shanth.com and at Shanth on Twitter and at Alexandra Mysore on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure she'd love to hear from you, especially
LinkedIn, email me.
Yes, I mean, especially if you're in that space that she's in. She's a great conversationalist, loves to talk about this stuff. And if you're still interested in the BizSpark program, and I hope you are, it's bizspark.com or www.microsoft.com/BizSpark. And you can reach out to me at Douglas Kretz on Twitter or at BizSpark on Twitter. And we're here to answer your questions about entrepreneurship or developing or using software to kind of build your company in this ecosystem. And I guess tune in next week, because who do we have online next week? I have to see, because I have not looked very recently. I think we're talking to Carl Thayer from Flight Hike. Yeah, so this will be the beginning of our next week. It'll be our travel-themed week. So, Alexandra, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's 2 weeks from now. Sorry. And we'll look for you online, okay?
All right. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.